Hello and welcome to Phoenix Rising, presented by Zwift, the ultimate indoor training app. Fun is fast, head to Zwift.com. Phoenix Rising is a new video podcast backed by the Phoenix Foundation, where we talk to some of the greatest athletes on the planet about what motivates them, about their mindset, and about how they rise. A look into the minds of those who have scaled the peak of physical endeavor, and what we can all learn and implement for our own lives. Now, episode 2 features arguably, and you'd probably be on the right side of that argument, the most popular triathlete on the planet, because honestly, there's nothing she won't try, and she excels just about every time. Recently crowned the 70.3 World Champion, she's a three-time Ironman World Championship runner-up, and a recent short course debutante as well. Of course, I'm talking about Lucy Charles-Buckley. Phoenix Foundation presents the Phoenix Rising Podcast, brought to you by Zwift, the ultimate indoor training app. Fun is fast, head to Zwift.com. Welcome to another episode of Phoenix Rising. Now, this podcast is all about mental resilience, the approach to elite sport, how you pick yourself up when you fall, and we all do, balance and all the things that go into elite performance, and what we can learn to implement in our own lives and to those of our kids, which is what the Phoenix Foundation is all about, to assist the next generation to grow through sport. And my guest today is the brand new, newly minted 70.3 world champion. Now, I'm sure she hasn't gotten sick of hearing that. In fact, when I went to check on her Instagram, it's gone straight to the top of the bio. So all the runner-ups are down the bottom, world champion at the top with a big gold cup, Lucy Charles-Buckley. Lucy, thank you so much for your time. So excited to have you on this podcast, as the journey's about the highs and lows, and you've got a unique journey. I guess everyone's is unique, but not a lot of people just stop their athletic career in the middle to go and work in a zoo for a bit and then come back again. So, I mean, we'll get to that in a minute, but let's start at the start. I mean, you're a swimmer, right? And you started swimming very early on. It didn't take long before the talent was recognised, I imagine. What do you remember from those your first steps in sport, if you like?
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks. First of all, thanks for having me on the podcast, Will. But yeah, I guess it all started when I was about 8 or 9 years old. A friend of mine was actually a swimmer at school, and we'd done kind of lessons at swimming at school, and I quite enjoyed it. So I decided I would go along with her to the local swimming club and instantly loved what I was doing. I just really enjoyed swimming. I enjoyed the competitiveness. And I guess growing up, I'd always been annoyingly competitive to my younger sister. So I needed to get into sport. And I feel like when I found swimming, that was definitely my sport. I instantly felt like I belonged there. And I just loved the gruelingness of the training, which was morning, night, every single day, training nonstop. And I just loved that commitment to something. And I think actually straight away, I didn't have like a super talent for swimming. I just loved to work hard. So when I was 9 years old, the 200 butterfly was the event I chose because I was like, that's the hardest event. That's the one I want to do. And then I kind of found distance freestyle and discovered actually that could be harder. And kind of from the time that I was 9, I was doing the 200 fly to the age of 16, I wanted to do the 10K marathon swim. So I'd always loved the hardest event. And I think that's why swimming is a pretty tough sport. And growing up, I definitely enjoyed it. But it got to a point where I was like, actually, I don't know if I can do this, if realistically I'm not going to make an Olympic Games, which was always the dream. So that's when I eventually ventured into triathlon when I was a bit older.
All right, so there's a ton to unpack there, right? So we've gone through, we've skated through 10 years there. But the very top, I'm like, okay, so I know your sister Holly. I imagine that being your younger sister and competing in sport is something that she's just not interested in doing. So does she just do no sport now because you just crushed her by being so talented and being older?
So,
like, is that what's happened?
I mean, that may well be true. We both used to do swimming as a sport. So I definitely did it because I wanted to win races. I wanted to be competitive. I wanted to race every weekend. My sister more did it for the social side. Like, she had some really great friends. She would go there more to see them than to train hard, I think. And I don't know if that's because, yeah, I put her off because I was all about wanting to be the best. I want to do everything better than everyone else. I want to outwork everyone at the pool. And that was more my mentality. And maybe she kind of thought, yeah, that looks like a bit too much hard work. I don't really fancy that, which is a smart thing.
Yeah. She went into the arts, right? She's a photographer. She's very artsy. She's like, this is my thing. You can keep your thing, Lucy. Thanks very much. But
I mean, were you inspired by sports people as a kid? Because obviously, you know, you have that competitive gene, you get in the pool. It could have been something else. It could have been any other sport. But was it sports people that you idolised as well? And who did you look up to at that time? And what did you take from their performances?
Yeah, so even as an 8-9-year-old, I used to enjoy watching swimming. So definitely, obviously, Michael Phelps is probably the biggest legend in swimming. And he was definitely one of the athletes that inspired me. And watching him win Olympic gold after Olympic gold was obviously so inspiring. And then we also had a lot of women that I looked up to in Great Britain. And at the time when I was doing distance freestyle, we had so much talent. We had Kerri-Ann Payne, we had Rebecca Adlington, we had Cassie Patton. We had all these women who were just amazing. And actually, I look back now and I kind of didn't realise how much depth we had in distance freestyle. And I think that's why it was so hard to make an Olympics at that time, because we just had so many amazing women who... Obviously, yes, I aspired to be like, but kind of actually now we have so many women not doing that event. So there's just no one doing it. So actually I went and competed in the 1500 freestyle this year at the Olympic trials and managed to come second by not even a second. It was so close. But back when I was swimming full time and I've swam faster, that was impossible. So I kind of didn't realise how much depth we had back then. But there was definitely a lot of people that I looked up to, not just in Great Britain, but obviously, yeah, the likes of Michael Phelps. And now someone like Katie Ledecky is just like out of this world phenomenal. And obviously she wasn't actually swimming back then, but now she is just someone who I think, wow, she's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it's watching those, because we've obviously got Ariane Titmus here who had all those battles with Katie Ledecky over the course of Tokyo. It's just so amazing to watch those guys and how much work has to go into it. And I guess when you say that, obviously you came in at a time, and when you were qualifying back at 2011 or 2010, you know, you were very young, like 19, I think. So you could still go to Paris 2024 in the 1500 metres. You could also go in the triathlon. I mean, is that figuring in your head right now?
Yeah, I think I enjoy triathlon so much more. So as much as I did enjoy going back into that swimming world, part of me, I saw the side of it that I love, but I also saw the side of it of why it's that actually I don't want to do this full time anymore. I love triathlon. I love the variety of that sport. I love the different challenges that triathlon brings. And actually just swimming morning and night every single day, I definitely do not want to go back into that world.
It sounds horrible, like the black line scenario. Like, I'll get in and do like 2Ks in the pool. I'm like, this is so boring and hard, and I just want it to end. And it wouldn't be hard for you maybe, but it's for sure boring, like, I think.
Yeah, I think.
You must get bored.
It's not so bad actually when I'm at home, because I swim with the local swimming club. And although I'm probably a minimum of 10 years older than all of them, it's quite nice to just go there and follow what the coach says and just do it. Whereas when I go away on a training camp and I'm making up the sessions, I'm writing them. And if I haven't written it down on a bit of paper before I go to the pool, then it is the most boring 2 hours of thinking, oh, right, what should I do next? So I always have to have a plan. Otherwise, it really is like, oh, what am I doing now? So always have a plan is my key tip for swimming.
Well, I mean, Reese might be making up a few sessions for you. You can argue with your husband. You can't argue with the coach of the local swimming club.
I know. Yeah, true.
Exactly. He knows that. So, I mean, and I know I had this written down because I know that I've heard you say before in previous interviews that we've done or shoots we've done is that that you always pick the toughest option, and you said it right off the top, and that's kind of the way you went through, and that was paired with an incredible talent or ability. But picking the toughest option might not be. I mean, it's not advice to give to kids necessarily, though, is it? I mean, that kids want to challenge themselves, but there's probably not. I mean, there's not so many people who might want to continually do that. Like you can be disappointing or it can be disheartening. So there's probably a fine line there for kids and parents who are listening to this and going, okay, I'm going to get my kid to do that. Well, you just got to make sure you get the wins in as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think you've got to pick something that challenges you just enough. So for me, I stopped doing swimming and I went and worked at a zoo and I'd lost that thing that I needed to work towards that was challenging me, which is why I did sign up for that first Ironman, because I needed something that scared me enough to work hard towards it. And that was how I got into that. And then actually this year, I've done a lot of different things that whilst they might not be the most physically hardest thing, they're actually a new challenge. So it's going to push me out of my comfort zone, which is something I do enjoy. I like to challenge myself. So yeah, it doesn't need to be the hardest thing on the world. Like I have no ambition to go and run 10 marathons in 10 days or something like that. Maybe not yet, but I like to do things that challenge me and kind of push me out of my comfort zone and allow me to learn new skills as well.
One thing that I think people could take away a lot from, because I also have seen it written where you said, you know, I had big shoulders when I was a kid. I used to get mocked for that, but my body is like my weapon and I've always gotten behind it. So I'm sure there's kids out there that have the same kind of, or they might be copying something for particular things, you know, a girl who's really tall or whatever, but then turns into an amazing netballer or whatever it is like that. How did you mentally cope with that and then turn that into fire or fuel for the fire or turn it around in your head when you were that young?
I feel like I was always quite a very confident kid in sport. And then actually when I went to school, I was quite quiet. So it wasn't until I kind of, when I was at school and I would get told, your shoulders are so big, why don't they look like this? And I'd be like, well, I swim every single morning, every single night, I want to make the Olympics. And I would have that fire of, well, I'm going to make the Olympics. And this is why I look like this. And people might laugh and go, well, you're not going to make the Olympics. And I was like, well, just watch, because I'm going to go far in sport. That's what I want to do. And I've never lost that fire. And I still feel like if anyone back then is now watching what I'm doing now, they'd be like, wow, like she definitely committed herself 100% to her sport and what she wanted to achieve. So I didn't really care what anyone thought because I was so driven for that goal. Like I was very tunnel visioned as a kid. It was like the Olympics or nothing. So that probably helped because I was able to just shut that out. But it's not the easiest thing. And actually, it's probably not until I look back now and I think, God, that was they were actually really mean, those kids. So, but yeah, I guess I just didn't really care because all I cared about was my own goals and what I wanted to do. And it's not easy to do that, but if you can, then you're definitely going to be successful at those things that you're actually working towards.
Well, and when you look back on all that you've accomplished, and you said the Olympic Games, and that was the pinnacle for like a number of years, obviously your whole childhood, and then it worked up to, you know, things worked out that it could potentially have been in London and the home games, and you mentioned that, and then to miss out on that spot. You were so young at the time that anyone who's been through a career would be like, don't worry, there's plenty more chances. But at the time, you're like, no. It's the London Olympics. It's my home Olympics. It's what I've worked towards. When you missed out on that and then you watched the event on TV at such a young age, what did that do to you mentally? And what was the process that you then went through to, I know you've tried to force it and go back and it didn't work out and then you gave it away, but across the course of that moment and then the months that followed, what was the mental process like?
Yeah, it was hard. I think I must have only been about 18, 19 at the time. So at that time, you think you're a fully fledged adult and you're going into the world. But actually looking back now, I was really young. And it was super tough watching that Olympic Games when your whole childhood had been thinking about the London Olympics. I remember going to Trafalgar Square when we actually got the bid for the Olympics, and I had got the day off of school to go and be there because my whole dream and the whole of my school knew that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go to the home game. So when I was 18 there watching and not actually doing it, it was so tough because everything I had been dreaming of was there and I wasn't doing it. So I did decide to make some changes and fully commit to the program. And in 2013, I did have one of my best ever years as a swimmer because I changed a lot of things. I swam at a new club. I fully dedicated to the program. I did more strength and conditioning. I just went all in. And for that one year, I had my best ever performance at a British Championships. But I did finish that race and was like, I just didn't feel anything. I should have been on top of the world because I'd done my best ever swim. But I was like, no, I know in this moment I can't carry on doing this because I've lost the love of what I'm doing. And if you don't enjoy or love what you're doing, you just can't do it. So in that moment, I knew I could not do another four-year cycle to the next Olympics. And that's when I just gave up everything.
And went to the zoo.
Yeah, I did.
It's funny because I say it's in the middle of your athletic career, but you were 19. I mean, you might not remember, but I read about your Wikipedia page. I know exactly how old you were. So, like, you know, what a departure. You just had to, it was so all-encompassing, I imagine, that you were just like, I have to do something completely different.
Yeah, I wanted to be completely out of that world. I just wanted to kind of switch my mind off to it, have a real mental break from sport. And yeah, I went and worked in marketing at a zoo, which was just the local zoo. My parents actually got married there. They had their wedding reception there. So it's a really cool place, actually. Like, I'd definitely go back there and visit anytime soon. And we did take Reese there for his birthday once. But yeah, it was just to have that mental break. And to be honest, it was within probably a matter of weeks, probably not even months, that I was like, you know what, I missed that drive for sport and having something to work towards. So I needed to train for something, and that was missing. So it really didn't take me long to realize that. And I guess when you've grown up and sport has been your whole life, it's not going to take long for that to creep back in. And that was actually when Reese and I signed up for our first Ironman triathlon, just because it was like I kind of said, you need a goal so big to scare you to work really hard for it. And that was what we did.
I feel like it would have been the most efficiently marketed, cleanest, best zoo for that period of 3 months that there's ever been, right? Just marketed it into the ground, pouring all of your competitive instinct into it. When you left, the animals were probably like, oh, thank God. Wow. I'm out. Okay, I'm out to sleep. We're going to hibernation for the next 6 months so we can recover from that whirlwind. But then you go from like zero competitive running and riding in 2014 to professional 2 years later, to second in the world like 2.5 years later in 2017, when you lost out to Daniela Reef, who's world number one. How surprising was that ascent to you? Because I know that when you finished, you had your best ever year in swimming, you came fourth in the British Championships, but then you go in 2 years to turn yourself from, I'm just going to try this Ironman on a mountain bike, which you didn't end up doing, but you thought about it, and to finishing second. Like, it's almost a giddying, like, rise up the list.
Yeah, it was completely unexpected. I definitely, when I first went into triathlon, I only wanted to do it for fun. I actually kind of hoped I wouldn't be that good at it, because I just wanted to enjoy it and just finish these races and have things to train for, chip away at small improvements. And actually, I didn't really expect to go that far with it. So when I turned professional, I was like, okay, you're going to be probably at the back of the pack. You're going to have a good swim. But if you're finishing top 10 in races, then you're doing pretty well. So actually, kind of my first few pro races, I was really happy to cut in the top 10, which I actually think was probably only actually the first pro race I did, which was the 70.3 in Dubai. I think I just scraped the top 10. But actually, then later that year, I went and raced. So I think Dubai must have been in February time. And then in April, I went and raced, and Daniela Reef was racing, and I actually beat her in that race. I came second to fellow Brit Emma Pallant by about 6 seconds. We both beat Daniela Reef, and it was actually after that race that I decided to go fully professional. So although I had my pro license, I was still working as a personal trainer at the time. So it was after that race I decided, you know what, I think if I can fully commit to training and not have to do a job around it, then I could actually be really good at this. And that was the same year that I then went on to come second at the World Championships. So 2017 was just a mad year. Like, I completely did not expect it. And that's really how my professional career took off.
As I understand it as well, like, in that race in 2017, you probably shouldn't have raced because you were carrying an injury, right? Like a leg injury into that. So, and it was getting bad. So you'd hadn't trained that well either in the lead up.
Yeah, I'd had an 8 week block of training in Lanzarote, and literally day one of that training camp, I did something to my hip doing a hard run on the treadmill. And I remember every single day of that training camp saying to Reese, oh, it'll be fine tomorrow, it'll be gone tomorrow. And all we spoke about for the whole training camp was my hip. And I drove him absolutely mental because I was like, I'm not going to be able to do the World Champs. I'm not going to be able to run. It's my first one and I just want to finish. And I remember us saying, well, look, realistically, it is your first one. There's no pressure. So even if you go there and have an amazing swim, an amazing bike, and you can't finish on the run, well, you've showed a little bit about what you're about on the swim and the bike. And I was like, but that's just not who I am. Like, I want to finish this race. And I knew that it would be a struggle. I just had not done the run training. I'd done so much biking though, so I knew I had some fitness from that. And we basically flew out to the World Champs about 2 weeks before the race, which is pretty standard just to acclimatize to the heat in Hawaii. And I remember kind of getting off that plane and thinking, well, my hip feels a bit better. Let's go for a run and see. And we went and did a couple of runs, and it really had eased off. It was almost like the magic of the island had helped my hip heal. But it probably actually in reality was that I'd had 4 days of not much training because we traveled and had some downtime. And maybe that's all it actually needed, was a few days of doing nothing. So I actually, in that moment, I was like, well, I know I can finish now. I believe even if I kind of hobble along a marathon, I will finish. But to actually then come second was just, it blew my mind, because I thought that top 10 would be like an unbelievable goal given kind of the training that I'd done. So yeah, it's my favorite finish to go back and watch is that race, because it was just so unexpected, and I can see the emotion in my face running down and finishing second on that first year. And I must have only been about 23, 24, so even then I was still young doing what I did. So that's still always a special race for me.
It's a 35-year-old's race. That's it. You got like when you cross the line, you're like, well, I got 10 more years of this. I've been 6 of these easy. Are you someone that goes back and watches your races at all, or do you try and move on?
Sometimes. So normally in the build up to Kona, I like to go and watch the old races in Kona, and I normally watch them on the turbo because I just find it quite motivating. And actually leading into what should have been the World Championships in Kona this year, I was like, right, I need to get my head back into that race and what it feels like at certain points in the race. I find it really easy to relive that if I'm actually watching the previous races, because it's such a brutal race and we haven't been there for so long now. So it's like, right, let's rewatch the races and get your head into that mindset of where you really do start to struggle and kind of prepare yourself for what's going to happen. And I'll definitely be doing that again next October because it will be 3 years since we were on the island. So yeah, I just like to do that kind of mental preparation as well.
Well, everyone needs to remind themselves. You need to remind yourself of what the course is, right? It hasn't been so long since we've been there. But in those, and then obviously when you're second in 2017, when you've had like an unbelievable rise over 2.5 years from amateur to age group world champion to qualifying to under 23, you know, blah, 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 off we went. Then second twice more. And when I say, and I often have to say in my job, Lucy Charles Barclay, 3-time vice world champion. And there's a glass half empty and half full scenario going on there, I reckon, because, you know, on one hand, yeah, unbelievable effort to become second 3 times. On the other hand, haven't won it. So, like, to be as blunt as that, you've got so many more years in the sport, you're going to win 5, there's no doubt about it. But second year, 2018, same result. Daniela Pasci, same time. She was gone and then just resurrected herself somehow and did the job. And then Annie, who's such a nice person, ran you down in the end in 2019. I mean, does the fire burn brighter each time? Because, you know, 2017, you're so amazed that you've done it. 2018, you do it again. 2019, you're like, this is my year to do it. Come close, don't quite get it done. And then we have to wait for 3 years. It's disgusting. But, I mean, does each time just re-motivate you to find the one percenters again? Because I know that your performance, even though the result has been the same, the performances have been much better year on year.
Yeah, definitely. Every single year the fire has grown. And actually I remember after 2018 just being so angry, so frustrated, because I knew I had done such a better performance. And yes, we had good conditions, so the times were fast. I'd done the second fastest time ever in the history of that race and still came second, so because the winner did the fastest time ever. So It was frustrating because I felt like that year was the year I deserved to win. And I remember finishing and actually just being annoyed. So the emotion was different. It was gone from elated, so emotional, could not believe I was second, to actually fuming that I was second and being really angry. And I actually needed to take a bit of time off after that race because I was so annoyed at the result and I was quite disheartened as well. So I did take a good break over the off season, mentally reset, and then I was ready to go and win it in 2019. And again, in 2019, I felt like I had an even better performance. I did take some risks. I rolled the dice, which then they didn't pay off on the run. My legs were cramping because I had pushed that second half of the bike a bit too hard. But that year, I wasn't annoyed that I'd come second. I was like, I know I gave it everything and I know the caliber of runner that Annie Haug is, and I train with her in Lanzarote. I see the work that she does, and I knew that if anyone deserved it more than me, it was her. So I was like, I'm okay with that, but I'm still now motivated in a good way rather than a negative way. So 2020, I believe, was my year. I was like, I'm going to do it. So obviously when we didn't have a Kona, that was so tough. And it was actually probably even tougher, I found, this year, because I knew I was in the best shape I've ever been to go and win. But I've done some different things this year and found motivation from kind of exploring different avenues and pushing myself in different ways. So I took it as a positive. I was like, my body has had now 2 years to kind of recover, work hard, work on skills that maybe I wouldn't have done. And I just hope we get to actually be on the island next October. We've obviously got the May World Champs as well, so we get two chances. But even if I were to win it in St. George, I think I need to win it on that island, because that's where I've been second three times. I want to go and win it in Kona.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. But you know what? A Utah one would not be bad just to throw up there. As long as you could guarantee that you could do it again 5 months later and you could just collect the whole set, that would be the plan.
That would be the ultimate plan. I think it's going to be a harder race for me to win in St. George, I believe. It's going to be a wetsuit swim, so I lose some advantage there. So actually, if I win in St. George, I will be far more confident that I could win it in Kona. So it's like a warm-up. Warm-up world champ.
Warm-up world champ. Yeah, no, I understand. Now, and you've alluded to this a couple of times. What has really impressed me over the past couple of years is because some people have just thrown their hands up and gone, oh, well, I'll just wait and train, or I'll do, you know, whatever I'm going to do. And just hung on. But what you have done is continually done what you did when you were a kid, which is find the toughest thing you could possibly do and then go and do that. And, you know, Alistair's the same. I just talked to him. He's just done a 750-kilometre gravel race because he's a madman. You know, and this is what makes you guys the absolute elite of the elite. So you mentioned the British 1500-metre trials where you came, as I said, second by 1 second or whatever it was in the end, 1.6 seconds or whatever. And then the arena games, which is like you've gone from 7-8 hours to 20 minutes. Leeds in the World Championship as well. And then Malibu, you did that for Super League as well. So, and what you don't have is a fear of looking out of place. You never do end up looking out of place, but I can see how you would go into something like that and go, all right, so my transitions aren't as tight, or I'm not used to racing at 100% for 10 minutes. I'm used to long efforts. And that's that kid mindset of tough challenges that you kept bringing. And people have just, I think you won a poll last week of being the most popular triathlete on the planet. And that's because of that stuff.
Yeah, I think, you know what, you can go in there and you might look stupid. Like I was quite nervous about Malibu because I knew I just hadn't had the time to do the work I would have liked. And actually going forward, I want to make sure if I'm on those start lines, I have done more preparation. But I think there's always going to be the critics out there. But actually, I don't really care, because it's like, well, would anyone else do it? Would anyone else kind of put themselves out there to maybe get it all completely wrong? And I don't think there's many people that would. So it's the best way to learn is to go and push yourself further out of your comfort zone. And yes, I know there's things I need to work on. And when you kind of go and do it at that level where every one of your weaknesses is exposed, it's very then easy to go away and know exactly what you need to work on. So I definitely know what those things are, and hopefully I've got more time to work on them going forward.
I went and crunched the numbers back on Malibu, because obviously I'm involved with Super League as well. And and you had the fastest run splits of the day, both of them, but by far. Like you ran quicker than anyone. Your bikes was where you were let down, but that course was so technical and tight, and those corners were so tight. But to come out of that and go, okay, the surf swim leveled the playing field somewhat. I mean, it's hard to say, but there's some great swimmers out there, right? Some people really battled out there, but it mixed up the order, let's say that. But then to go, I came away with the quickest run splits of the day against these women who are the best in the short course business. That's just, and then to do it off the back of leads, you must just continually go, is the Olympic Games calling to me? Am I going to reverse what everyone does and go long to short instead of short to long? Am I going to go long to short to long? Is that what I'm going to do? Is that the plan after seeing those numbers come back?
Yeah, I think it really did surprise me, actually, because obviously it was the week after 70.3 Worlds, and on the bike, I just felt like I had nothing. Like, my legs just did not want to push. And actually, every round, I felt like technically I was learning, which was great. But I just, even on the straights, I was like, I'm just getting dropped because I cannot push anything. So then it surprised me that you could get off the bike where you felt that bad and you could start running and feel amazing. So I was like, that's why I was so gutted, actually, that I just got eliminated on that last round, because I had a short shoot and I was running so well. So I was like, what could have happened if I just not got eliminated? So yeah, who knows? But it was a great confidence boost, because actually, so I'm going to be racing in Abu Dhabi in about 3 and a bit weeks at the WTCS race there. And to me, that's now become easier because I've done the Super League. So I know that there's more time in the bank. It's a 10-kilometer run. So if I lose time on the bike, it's 10K to make up time. It's not going to be a rough sea swim, I hope. Because like you said, that just was crazy in there. And it did level the field, because you're not really swimming. You're all just battling it out with the waves. So it was a great learning experience. But I definitely think if you want to be good at the Olympic distance, then Super League is definitely the way to do it, because you just have to hone in on every single skill. You cannot make a mistake. And yeah, it highlighted where my weaknesses are. So now I know what to go and work on.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at someone like even a Mario Mola, who cannot keep up in Super League racing, three-time world champion, needs that run leg, you know, to come back and win these races. And you know, there's no, I mean, I would not be surprised even in the slightest if you went to Abu Dhabi and won that thing. Are you doing Challenge Daytona as well after that?
It's a question mark at the moment. So Reese definitely is. And for me, it will just be kind of hanging on to have that rest. I haven't had a rest yet. So we'll see if I can hang on a bit longer and do that race before I have a rest, but I'm not committing to it yet.
I don't believe you in this after all the stuff you've done, that you're going to not go back to Daytona again after finishing second there. come off it. Okay, so next year, what's the plan? Because you know, we've got Kona Light in May in St. George, and then four weeks later is a sub-8 project. So, you know, we've been talking to all the athletes, because it's a Phoenix project, about what they're going to do about that. And people are split. But I'm hearing that you're planning on doing both. Is that correct?
Yeah, without a doubt. Like, I'll definitely do both. I think I know I'm an athlete who recovers quickly. So obviously 2 weeks after doing 70.3 Worlds, I was running the London Marathon and felt fine. So,
oh, I forgot about that. Wow, you're a mad.
So I know I can recover quick. I think the most difficult thing in my planning will be, I definitely think a lot of the girls who I want to have on my team will also be racing in St. George, so they need to be recovered to help me. So it may just be that we have to kind of adjust maybe who some of my paces are, but to me, I think it will work. It won't be an issue. And then it just gives me more time to kind of then work towards October, the Kona there. So next year is hectic. It's busy. We've been given dates for the PTO races, which are likely to happen as well. I might want to do some short course racing. So I don't think I'm going to have many weekends off next year. I think it's going to be full on. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it, which is exactly why I definitely Daytona's a question mark because I feel like I just need a bit of downtime before I go into what's probably going to be my craziest year ever of triathlon. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I mean, you've definitely proved to yourself over the last few months that you can continually back up and do it over different distances, because when you go from 70.3 Worlds win to Malibu 6 days later to the London Marathon and run like a 2:37 or some madness, 2:47, I think it was. I don't know. Anything under 3 hours to me is like, you may as well just, don't even tell me what it is. But you've shown yourself that you can do it over multiple distances. And then so you take that and you take your win in St. George, and it's so good because you won by 9 minutes and it's absolutely mad. And then 4 weeks later, sub eight, it seems tailor-made for you, this kind of thing. And I know that when we put the word to you and say, wait, what do you reckon? And then you were like, yeah, I'm in 100%. So what is it that about the idea of it and the concept, I guess, of like the clock and the pinnacle of human achievement that speaks to you? And then is there a small voice in the back of your head going, I could do sub 7.5, or I could beat Yarn, or, you know, like, I mean, what's your thought processes around the attempt itself and then how you're going to approach it from a mindset perspective?
Yeah, I love the whole idea of the project because there's so much strategy to it. So you can pick 10 women to assist you on this journey to try and break that 8-hour barrier. And actually, I've always wanted to see how fast I could go over that distance. So this is a great way of doing it with 10 women that can help me. And we have to be so tactical about when we bring them in. How far are they going to ride on the bike before they get a rest and come back in? So I love all of that. There's so much to think about on the run. Do I actually want people who can run stupidly quick times, or do I just want people who are just going to be positive, keep me in a good headspace when I'm struggling? So normally I'm doing an Ironman and I'm out there on my own. No one's in my ear to give me anything positive. It's just me trying to tell myself, right, let's keep positive, we're doing well, we're in the moment. Whereas actually here, I'm going to have people to keep me positive and keep me pushing on. So what I also love about it is if I can absolutely annihilate that 8-hour barrier, get nearer to what the men's times are when they go and do it, I do believe that it will give me the confidence to maybe one day believe I could go under 8 hours on my own as well. So it's like a giving you that mental belief of actually, well, physically I did it. Yes, I had some people assisting me, but my body had to do it. So actually one day, could I do that on my own without anyone helping me? So yeah, I'm really excited for it. And I'm excited to pick who those women are going to be. Am I going to be able to find anyone fast enough to come into the swim that isn't a Katie Ledecky or someone like that? Am I just going to do that part on my own and then know that there's going to be women ready to help me on the bike and the run? So still a lot to think about. And I also have said I do love the idea of it being a completely British team as well, because obviously Chrissy Wellington has the fastest time over that distance so far. I'd like to keep it that it was a full British effort to break her time and go under that 8-hour mark.
But is there the names? Have you found the names, or are you going, well, I don't know if I can do it? I mean, is there a swimmer, or is there two swimmers that are going to that swim for Great Britain? Or is it like, okay, what's Katie Ledecky's Instagram account? I'll slide into the DMs. What do you do? What are you doing next June? You know, are you busy? I mean, is there the personnel there, or are you finding it hard to find them, as you said?
Well, I haven't slid into Katie's DMs yet, but it might be worth a shot. I mean, who knows?
shoot your shot. Shoot your shot, Liz. Come on.
You can't. There's nothing to lose, is there? So fancy it? Yeah.
Up against Nicola. So she's such a different athlete. I mean, she's going to be 40 years of age. She's incredible. Like, we all know what she's done on and off, inside and outside of triathlon is just unbelievable. And you're going to be probably, I mean, you're going to find yourself in a similar position to what you find yourself in all triathlons, where she's back there somewhere. How fast is she going? I don't know. But see, because this time we're going to be at the Lausitz Ring. You're going to get into there. You're going to know exactly where she is because you're going to be able to see her at all times. So how much does that help you? And also, how great is it to race against someone of her caliber? I mean, no one has done what she's done in the Olympics as a female, and also 6 European championships, and she's still winning at 39 now.
Yeah, she is just incredible. I mean, what a woman. The fact that she's still going, she's still absolutely crushing it, winning races, like beating women that are like at least 10 years younger, if not more. So I think I love the element of that. It's not just one woman doing it, one man doing it. The fact that there's still a competitive element as well, I think it makes it more fun, but it also is going to drive us both on to be better. And again, I don't know who Nicola's picking to assist her. So she could have some incredible women that I know nothing about. So yeah, it's going to be fun because I'm going to obviously have more focus on the time, but there's going to be a little bit of a look back. What's Nicola doing? Is she gaining time? Is she chasing me down? So, I mean, in an ideal scenario, we will both go under that 8-hour barrier, but I want to make sure that I'm under it more than she is. So yeah, it's going to push us both on for sure to be that bit competitive as well.
You know what's fun? I know what everyone's doing, but nobody else knows what each other is doing. It's very nice. It's a good position to be. I know some names of what Nicola's doing. I know a little bit about what Alice is doing. I know a little bit what Christian's doing. No one knows anything else. And I get to keep it all to myself. I feel very smug. I feel extremely smug about the whole thing. Although you, out of all the athletes, you have kept it as close to your chest as possible. I at least know some names from the others. You won't give me a single pacemaker name, will you?
No. Be a top secret.
No, you are. I'm going to start having to force it. I'm going to go back to the contracts, actually. I think I need to go back to the contract and find out exactly what you have to tell me, all right? Because I need something, but you guys are like smoke and mirrors. Trying to get hold of your team is like trying to catch smoke. You're good. So, I mean, Phoenix, obviously you've been involved with Phoenix in this capacity and you've seen no doubt what we've been doing in triathlon, but also, you know, in more broadly with kids and in all different sports. I mean, what do you like about that association that you have with the foundation? Because, you know, obviously everything we do is directed back, including sub-7, sub-8, into inspiring or assisting kids to play sport, and we're moving into lots of different countries with lots of really cool projects. I mean, it must be something nice that... It's just not a money-making exercise. It's just for one purpose only. And for me, there's something pure about that. And I'm sure that you probably feel the same way.
Yeah, 100%. I think the Phoenix stands for everything that I stand for as well. It's about inspiring the next generation of athletes to get into sport. And if it's not triathlon, which obviously I'd love it if it was, because it's such an amazing sport, but there's so many sports out there. So it's just encouraging these younger athletes to give sport a go. And everything that sport brings is just that community, that drive to push yourself out of your comfort zone, see what you can do. It's everything that I want to do with sport, and it's the legacy that I want to build with what I'm doing as well. So I really do love that. I love that as part of the Sub-8 project, each of us athletes are also raising money for charity as well. So there's a big charity feel for the project. Just the fact that hopefully these young women are going to watch what I'm doing on this Sub-8 project and be like, wow, like I want to try and do that. I want to go and maybe do my first triathlon and one day try and do that long distance and see how fast I can go. So it's just such a great initiative. I'm so proud to be part of not just the Sub-8 project, but obviously the Phoenix Foundation as well. And yeah, hopefully I can just bring more and more attention to that with what I'm doing in sport. And there's so many things that I love to do as well, like with the battle braids and getting the young girls to braid their hair, go and do a run, go and do a triathlon. It's everything that I'm about. So yeah, I'm super proud to be part of it.
That reminds me. So the other day, I'm very lucky because I get to send videographers out and photographers all to all our different events in all different countries. And then my emails just fill up with all these different photos and like tons and tons of stuff. And then I sort through it all, and that's what you see on the social media. And then I found this photo from Australia, from the very first Australian triathlon, kids triathlon, which was the other week. And there was this girl riding. I must have got 500 photos from this event. And then she had the battle braids with the pink, right? And this is in Queensland, Australia, right? So it couldn't be any further away from where you are right now. And I'm like, I've seen this photo before. So then I went back to Super League's photos because I got all of them as well. And I'm like, I found the exact same photo. I'm like, oh, split screen. Has to be, 100%. And then I saw that you saw that and you're commenting on that. And then suddenly, you know, then this girl who I've never seen before, I've never met before in my life, is like, you know, it's a big deal for her because then she gets to hear from you, and like that just perfectly fills the circle for Phoenix. I mean, she looked like a future professional.
She looked like an absolute badass. Like, she must have been about 10 years old and she was going all in on that bike. She had her braids in. And I think that's one of the things I don't just love about sport, but I love about how social media can actually be used for good, how you can inspire others. And yeah, you've got me at 28 doing it, her at 10 doing it. And yeah, it's just amazing to see. So yeah, I absolutely love that picture. I was like, whether she'd done the pink braids just because she'd seen mine were pink or whether that was a coincidence, I don't know. But she had the braids in and she was going all in. And yeah, absolutely incredible.
Well, if you can slide into her DMs, you can slide into Kayla Deckies. Okay, so you can trade down, you can trade up. It's that circle of life, social media, bringing it all together. Very good. Now, speaking of social media, something slightly different is that Zwift are coming on board as a presenting partner of Sub 7, Sub 8. And I know that you're a massive fan of Zwift and you're on there all the time. And in fact, I've called races on Zwift of you racing it in that weird time of COVID where suddenly we were commentating online e-gaming. But what do you think of Zwift coming on as a partner? What do you think of Zwift as a platform? And I know that you really enjoy it and it really pushed you, especially during the lockdown.
Yeah, I mean, I've been an avid user of Zwift since very early on into my triathlon training because I do live in a very busy area near London. So a lot of my training is done indoors. So I've always loved the platform that I can ride with other athletes. I can make group rides. So if I want to ride with my friends during the lockdown, we all rode on there together. We could speak to each other on there. So always been a huge fan of Zwift. I love that Zwift are coming on board as part of the Sub 8 project. I'm also in some discussions with them about potentially using their platform to gain a rider for my team. So that is something I will give away, is that we may allow a rider to go through Zwift to actually make it onto my team. So that could be super cool. It's obviously a way of us kind of branching out a bit more into that platform and using that to find some talent for the team. So yeah, very early discussions with them about that, but I think that could be a great way of making someone else on my team.
That is extremely interesting stuff from you, Charles Barclay, because I was just having this exact same discussion with Christian Blumenfeld, who wants to do the same thing. Now that it's out there for you, it could be out there for him as well. He thinks that someone will need to hold 400 watts. Now, how many watts does someone have to hold to be on Lucy Charles Barclay's pacemaking team?
Well, not as much as Christian's, thankfully. But we haven't got to go quite as fast as him. So it depends on the amount of length of time I want them to come in for each stint. So the rider on the front, I would say, needs to be riding around 300 watts for a stint. That's quite a lot more than I have to push when I ride an Ironman. So I think that would be a good amount. But obviously, if we can find a rider that can do even more than that, that's not going to be a bad thing. So yeah, I'm excited to see what talent we can find.
It is going to be great. It's going to be fantastic to watch and it's going to be inspiring. And that's what we're here to do. Thank you so much, Luz, for joining us across the last 50 minutes or so. It's been great to get some insights into your journey and I hope people have taken away a little bit about that high-performance mindset. Now, go and get ready for Abu Dhabi. Go and smash that. And then just have a break, man. Put your feet up. I can just sit in the pain cave with a big tub of ice cream and just watch Netflix for a day and make the rest of us feel better, okay?
Will do.
Thanks very much, Luz. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.